Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Todd Cast. As Texas residents receive a giant power bill for grid failure during a storm the state was extremely unprepared for, Republican Governor Abbott has reopened businesses and removed the mask mandate. A true all-or-nothing approach. So what does that mean for this large state and all the others? For that, I'll be joined by Texas Tribune's Abby Livingston. On the national scale of things, we've talked about Biden's plan. But how about Congress's? They passed a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill in the House. So what's next? The moderate Democrats say they're frustrated with the party leadership's agenda. And I've got Leanne Caldwell from my colleague NBC News here to tell us why. Plus, is it time for two more states? Two more stars on that flag. Later in the show, I'll speak with Puerto Rico's Governor Pedro Pierluisi. It's a great conversation about Puerto Rico's path for statehood and how the fight for D.C. statehood helps or hurts their campaign. We'll talk about chances of passage of statehood in the Senate, particularly among Republicans. There already are a few votes for Puerto Rico statehood, more votes than D.C. statehood has on that. But first, let's start with Abby and Leanne. Welcome back to the Toddcast to both of you.
Howdy.
Hi.
Leanne, let me start with the COVID relief plan, big picture scale of things. This feels like we are, you know, when you get on certain amusement park rides and you know you're on a track and you know there's going to be ups and downs and there might be an upside down, but you're on a track. And no matter what, the end of the ride is predictable. Is that what's going on here in the Senate?
That's what I think is going on. Everyone's trying to get their last minute input into this legislation. Moderates are wanting things more targeted. Progressives want things less targeted. Republicans, even though they're likely going to vote against the bill, are trying to get some things they want into the bill. And that's what the amendment process is for. But in the end, it's going to be essentially the same. And this is the time of the airing of the grievances and try to get
this
some.
This is the best of its time on Capitol Hill. It's the airing of the grievances week.
Right. Always. That's pretty much every day
right,
on Capitol Hill.
The airing of the grievances.
But yeah, I mean, Schumer said this week that he is very confident that he will have the vote. There's little margin of error. They can't lose one Democrat. But in the end, this is Biden's signature legislation to start off his administration. And I don't think there's going to be a Democrat that's going to want to take
that. What's been interesting to me is watching the Republicans search for a way to be against this bill. The minimum wage was the easy thing. Then that disappeared. How have you seen their attempts at trying, you know, then the latest, I think, spin has been, well, only 9% of the bill is targeted at COVID. You know, specifically COVID related, which is a very, shall we say, I think, subjective definition of how you would look at the bill. But to me, that felt like a spaghetti at the wall opposition approach.
That's exactly what they're doing. They're kind of all over the place on this. I remember when you asked me that question last week on MTP Daily, I had just left a press conference with Kevin McCarthy where he was talking about the Pelosi payoff. And it was just—
Oh, by the way, they took that out.
Yes, they did take that out. And it was also so— It was such an absurd, almost small component of this massive bill that it didn't even stick. Like, reporters didn't latch on to it. It was a messaging failure. And I think that that's part of the problem with these Republicans is that they're trying to find something that sticks to oppose this bill, but they're not all on the same page. It's not really working, especially when just a month or two ago, they supported most of this stuff.
Susan Collins, the only potential vote for this bill on the Republican side of the aisle?
Yes.
What about Murkowski?
It's going to be interesting. Yeah. She's going to have some amendments to try to change.
Are her amendments legit ones? Like, a lot of the amendments are BS, political statements. The Collins amendments, are those the ones Schumer's paying attention to?
Yes, those are the legit ones. And what I'm hearing is they're not even hot button issues. They're actual policy things that she thinks were left out of the legislation pertaining to, you know, healthcare and other things that were in previous COVID bills that weren't included in this one. So she's not doing very much, from what I understand, any political posturing with her amendments. She actually is trying to get things that she wants in the bill put into the legislation.
Abby, before I jump into the sort of the Texas-centric aspect of what I want to talk with you about, on COVID here, Governor Abbott going to refuse all of this Democratic passed money that's going to get sent to his state? Or is he going to reluctantly, of course, I'll take it. I just don't think we needed it.
Well, I mean, Medicaid, that is what Texas tends to do, is reject it. I hadn't thought about that. I think things are just finally starting to turn for Texas, and it's just been a beating. And I'm sure we're going to get to it, but when he signaled that he was going to revoke his orders about where you can eat in restaurants and not having to wear a mask in public, I think he was signaling there's not a lot of soul searching after the winter storm of limited, becoming more in favor of expanded government rather than limited government. I think what I'm seeing, at least on COVID, is a double down. I don't know if it'll apply to that policy issue, Texans need money. These schools need to be retrofitted just like everywhere else. So, you would think that they would accept it, but it certainly counters philosophy.
How's this relief bill playing in Texas? Is it one of those things that's more popular with the public than it is with the partisans?
I haven't seen any specific polling on that. I do think it. I've never seen morale in Texas the way it is right now, particularly after the winter storm. That was just a gut punch after a year of solitary living. And then Texans for a week were literally sitting in the cold, damp, wet darkness. And the morale is just really beaten down. And I think Biden plays better in Texas than any Democratic president in my awareness of politics, going back to Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would play better than what we saw with the stimulus. I keep thinking about 12 years ago with the stimulus and how that became a dirty word. And I don't see that here. I think the COVID situation is so pervasive. It's not just affecting, the supply chain of auto parts and things like that, that I think it will be more welcome, particularly in the school system.
So trying to understand Governor Abbott's motivation, a writer over at The Atlantic wrote, ending precautions now is like entering the last miles of a marathon and taking off your shoes and eating several hot dogs. It does feel like we are in a race between stupidity and the vaccines. We have a finish line. It's there. Yet there is this sense of, let's just do it now. Everybody is looking for a political motive as to why Governor Abbott made his decision. Is there one? And what is it? It looks to me like more like 22 than 24. And it looks as much about turning the page from the winter storm. But what say you?
He has been under enormous pressure from his right flank over some of these policies restricting where you can go and when you can go and things like that. And there are percolating rumors, none of which I would have a potential challenge. But I also, I'm not in Texas, I'm in DC right now, but I step back and I look at CPAC and I see how well over Ron DeSantis, Kristi Noem, they're going over other governors. And I can't help but think that maybe that's in the back of Abbott and his team's head. But I don't know that for a fact. But
they've been out in Texas.
Do what?
You think that's Abbott going, hey, wait a minute. We're supposed to be the big and brash ones here, not South Dakota and Florida. Is it a little bit of that, you think?
I think that's a potential thing. And then I remember he put restrictions on for March, April, and into May, and then he started to lift them up. And the rates were not going down. There really wasn't anything indicating that this was a good idea. And everyone on my Facebook feed who I grew up with went out to dinner, and they were treating it like homecoming. And that's kind of, there is a response like that coming out of what I'm seeing in Texas. There is giddiness. There's also apoplectic horror, particularly in the Austin strain of my Twitter feed. The dominant grocery chain, HEB, is not mandating masks inside the store. And, I just keep thinking about what that would feel like to go to the grocery store. When I spent 2 months in Texas earlier, or at the end of this year, I was in Fort Worth and everyone wore a mask, and that's what Abbott is encouraging. He's saying, we don't need to tell y'all what to do anymore. You know what to do. And so I was sort of impressed. People were wearing masks more in public than in DC, which is where I normally live. And so I guess he's just saying the onus is on you to take care of your neighbor.
Leanne, let me go back. I know I'm ping-ponging here a little bit, but when COVID relief ends, are we immediately going to be jumping into an infrastructure fight because that's the next place that they can do reconciliation? Are we now going down this road where Democrats are always going to be looking for what is, you know, as much as they may want to do voting rights and they may want to do immigration, the beeline to 50 votes is budgetary. So go with a spending package like infrastructure.
Yeah. So I think that there's two separate tracks that are happening in the House right now. The first is all the things that can't go into budget reconciliation that they're trying to do. All of these Democratic priorities like, you know, voting rights today, you know, the LGBTQ rights last week, the George Floyd policing bill this week, the list goes on and on. So they're trying to rush these things through the House, even though they just have, they're very partisan Democratic bills for the most part. On the other hand, then the stuff that perhaps could go through budget reconciliation again, because they know that they have one more they can use this year. They're expecting that to be in the fall. Infrastructure is a prime example. There is some talk on Capitol Hill of trying to see what they can do in a bipartisan way on infrastructure, because traditionally infrastructure is one of those pieces of legislation that has gotten bipartisan support.
Yeah, we've been saying that for a decade. And there have been, and bridges fall down in Florida and in Minnesota. And I mean, you know what I mean? We, every year we get the grade, oh, America's infrastructure, it's now a C minus, you know, it's like, okay. Like, and yet this is the easiest thing Congress can do. It's been so easy. We haven't
it's so true. And yeah. And I mean, maybe with earmarks back in the House, they can get it done a little bit easier. But also infrastructure is going to be difficult this year because this is where a lot of their climate change components are going to be. They're going to stick it in this infrastructure bill. So I was just talking to a chairman of a committee yesterday, a relevant committee, who said that the next reconciliation bill, like, it could be multi-pronged, multi-issued, and just massive. Perhaps they stick Dreamers alongside reconciliation or alongside infrastructure, alongside, you know, the long list of things that they can't get done with 60 votes in the Senate. So
it's like an old lame duck Congress, but it will be the lame reconciliation duck. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I called it a reconciliation of us.
Oh, nice. Reconciliation of us. I see what you did there. Okay. I see what you did there.
So, I mean, they're trying to figure it out. You know, but all this talk of bipartisanship, they don't have a lot of plans for that.
I want to pick out a couple of the issues with you, Abby, that are very Texas specific and trying to understand what has changed. I want to start with voting rights. Texas was at the forefront of increasing access to the polls. You know, early voting, I feel like, was invented in Texas. You know, the idea of in-person early voting. And this is when Republicans were calling all the shots. Is this just a proof that Trump runs the party now? That a system that essentially was pretty apolitical and people were sort of in favor of, oh yeah, convenience voting, that's bipartisan, let's do that, has suddenly become polarizing. What's your explanation in Texas?
I mean, there is absolutely no doubt this is Trump's party in the state of Texas. And I think that Republicans were not too keen on expanding access to voting before Trump, but it's much more, they will do whatever he wants. It is impossible to get through a primary, which is funny because Texas kind of took a little bit longer to fall into the Trump camp. There had been the Cruz
more
and
so
Bush.
The Bush wing was strong, right?
More so than most of it.
The Bush wing was strong.
It was a slower
right?
process. And I mean, I saw the day it happened. It was the day after Ted Cruz was booed at the Republican convention in the Texas hotel. You could just watch it in slow motion as people were literally, it was almost like watching Red Rover or something in the hotel lobby. It's fully consolidated. And I think it's going to be fascinating because even though Will Hurd, the moderate congressman, has retired, and we have a, it's not just him, all of the Republican members of Congress who are coming in are much more Trump favorable than the people they replaced, including Mac Thornberry. He was replaced by Trump's physician, Ronnie Jackson. Right. And so the adoration for Trump is right. a sight to behold in the state, in the rural areas. I mean, just the flags flying, that, and then the cities are going the completely opposite direction. So it is really a bifurcated, strange place, even just walking around in my childhood right. neighborhood.
On immigration, given, and we ran in First Read today, those numbers from the border counties in Texas to just show the changes that have taken place in Texas specifically. And when you see the where the Biden administration wants to go with immigration, if they pursue that aggressive path, is that a recipe for making Texas further out of play or more in play?
Oh boy, immigration's a tough to break down. That is the most dominant issue in a Republican primary for anyone running for office, whether it's state-led, Congress, or statewide. And that is, how far to the right can you get? In South Texas, it does not always break down that way. There are many families who've been in Texas going back to the Spanish days, and so they may not always be as open to immigration, path to citizenship, as other Hispanics in the state. What I can say, Republicans are absolutely delighted with going after South Texas. There's a congressional seat down there that was so close and it was not even on my radar. And everything when you talk to a Republican consultant has to do with South Texas. Now, what some Democrats will say is the fatal error was not door knocking, and that when they bring that back, things will start to settle down. I'm just kind of scratching my head because I didn't see this coming. And I think a lot of strange things are playing. I think defund police is a very difficult slogan mm-hmm. to run under as a Democrat in South Texas, because there's so many people who are employed mm-hmm. by law enforcement down there, including the Border Patrol. So I think it's very complex. I remember 15 years ago, George W. Bush, Kay Bailey Hutchison, they were not draconian about immigration. And I think the modern Republican Party in Texas probably will be.
So, Leanne, you taking that into account, right? And when you look at sort of how the Democrats gain or lose a majority, this is what makes me wonder about immigration, right? And about how much there is, you know, it's funny. It's like politically, it's so hard. It's so beyond necessary. Our laws are just ridiculously out of date. Yet we know that this is it. It can politically, it might feel impossible to both solve the problem and not pay a political price. Are Democrats ready to pay a political price to pass the immigration bill they think is necessary?
Yeah, that's a great question. So over the years, the trust between the parties, I mean, it's always been a wedge issue, right? And more recently, over the past couple of years, you hear Republicans say, Democrats don't want to solve this issue. This is good for them, but it might, keeping it still out there dangling to get Latino, Hispanic voters to the polls to vote for Democrats because of their promises of solving the immigration problem that never end. But now perhaps that they have an incentive to actually solve it. If you look at places like South Texas, where regardless of what is happening in the immigration debate, they move more to the Republican Party. So I don't know. I mean, I think that as far as the politics of immigration, it was very clear that Biden introduced an immigration bill very early on as a campaign promise to the voters and the Hispanic voters who have been demanding it. But it was also a much more progressive bill than has been brought up before. Don't see how it passes. So is this again another shiny object right. to appease Hispanic voters and Latino voters and the activists without actually doing something about it. You know, Republicans will tell you all day and all night that Democrats have no intention of solving the problem.
Well, I've said this before, I think on this podcast, I feel like Democrats treat immigration the same way Republicans treat healthcare. They know what they're against. They're afraid of saying what they're for, and they're afraid of putting that down. Democrats are afraid of talking about what they're for in border security. But they will tell you what they're against in border security, just like Republicans are afraid to tell you what they're for in healthcare, but they'll tell you what they don't want. And you know, it is one of those things that they know how to run against it. You know, Abby, I think one of the other reasons why you're on today, I feel like also it's like Texas is forcing itself into becoming sort of the state we have to pay attention to, whether we all like it or not. And you're going to have the first important congressional special election that will allow a lot of us to overread what it means. It is from an area that you're very familiar with. It's the Fort Worth area. So what about this district? It's not supposed to be a swing district, but it has been competitive. Is this part of the suburban trend that we've been seeing throughout the Fort Worth area and the larger metroplex? Was this specific to this district that this was slightly more competitive than we thought? Or is this, you know, and is there going to be something to be learned about the political climate going into 2022 in this first special election, which voters will start voting in about 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks?
I do believe special elections are special, and oftentimes we do take too many lessons out of this, but I think there will be much to learn. And I'm less interested in the actual margin, you know, who wins or loses, than the bigger picture. And we've already learned one thing. This thing is stacked with candidates on both sides. And so this is the Texas 6th Congressional District. It's to replace Ron Wright, who passed away. He's been battling cancer and he was diagnosed with COVID. And so this is Arlington, which is the east side of Tarrant County, which is sort of now the swing county of Texas. Mm-hmm. And that is, it used to be the largest Republican county in the state, and it is on Democratic. And it extends deep into rural areas south. And this is, I think it is on the edge of the Rangers and the Cowboys Stadium. I don't think they're technically in the district. And this was a district I never even paid attention to when I started this job 5 years ago. In 2018, they got a candidate who was pretty good at raising money. Her name was Jana Lynn Sanchez. And she ran against Ron Wright. This is Joe Barton, who retired, sort of forced into it because of a scandal. And she did pretty good. She ran a competent campaign and I think got it in the single digits. And then there was another race. She didn't run in 2020. Democrats sort of made a play for it, kind of a half-hearted, like they made sure reporters knew and donors knew this race was happening, but they did not put the investment in like they did other districts in the state. And this whole big offensive in 2020 was basically Democrats came up, didn't win any offensive positions. And so it was a huge disappointment. And again, like I said earlier, some Democrats say the door knocking was the problem. And I think this is the great lab to find that out. It's also a jungle primary. So it will be a top two. And Sanchez is running again, as is several candidates. The late congressman's wife, Susan Wright, is running. I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. They could lock each other out. It could be just Republicans in the top two, or it could be just Democrats. Mm-hmm. But if it's a one-on-one, I think we'll have a mm-hmm. sense of what the world looks like without Donald Trump on the ballot.
Yeah. So what you're saying is if our top two, the one problem with this for us to look for clues is that there's a chance the top two could be one party on each. So sort of throw us off here.
And yes, and the amazing thing is it's probably going to get carved up in redistricting. So a temporary.
That was going to be my next question, is like, how likely does this seat survive redistricting? And it sounds like not very likely. All right. Let me close with a topic you both can you both deal with, and it's Mr. Cruz. So, Leanne, let me start with the national picture and his reputation in Congress, in the Senate. Is it as bad as sort of Lindsey Graham and Al Franken both like to joke that it is, that or did Josh Hawley at least take the mantle of most despised senator from Ted Cruz? But realistically, what is his personal relationships on the Hill?
So after the January 6th insurrection, talking to a lot of Republican aides, the response was they didn't see how Josh Hawley, a newish member, gained the respect of his fellow senators again. But regarding Ted Cruz, it was always like, we all knew who he was. No one really respected him anyway. So Ted Cruz is just going to Ted Cruz. After his jaunt to Cancun, my colleague Carol Lee and I reported that his Senate colleagues played a trick on him in the Senate gym, posted a meme in all the Senate lockers making fun of him going to Cancun. And all my sources said, oh, it was for sure. We don't know who it was, but we bet it was a Republican senator who did that.
This is the part of Cruz that I think, like, he's weirdly likable among some because he can take a joke, right?
I guess. I think that people don't care what he thinks.
Okay.
People just like I said, Ted Cruz is going to Ted Cruz. He's kind of what he is. People have accepted it. He's going to flip flop all over the place on every issue, regardless of the political wind. Something that Lindsey Graham does too, but Graham seems to do it much more effectively.
With a little more charm. Yeah. There's a little more charm.
Yeah. The future of Ted Cruz though, in the Senate and on the political, on the national scale, you know, he'll probably stay in the Senate for 40 more years, but
assuming he can continue to get reelected.
Okay,
well, let's turn to Ms. Livingston for that. I mean, look, Ted Cruz, I know that Cruz is as polarizing among Republicans as he is among the general population, right? Like, he is one of these people that everybody has an opinion on, particularly in the state of Texas. Time is clearly on his side because it's not 22, it's 24 that he would have to make a decision on what to run for and all of that. But what is his standing in the state, and is it recoverable?
So I think the thing I've tried to think through the 2018 Senate race of Beto versus Cruz over and over, and I try to apply that to the 2020 with Cornyn. And the question I don't have an answer to on that is, was that about Beto O'Rourke and people adoring him and him running this unique campaign, or was this about people really not liking Ted Cruz? I think the thing that my phone exploded that day when the photos were online, but we weren't 100% sure it was him, of people just saying, is this true?
Right.
People I'd grown up with who I hadn't even heard from in a long time. And I just think it kind of broke some people who, being a U.S. senator, and I mean, Texas is the second largest state in population. We're 30 senators and one of them left. And the senators, you know, there was this argument that the senator's job they don't really have a job in the middle of a crisis. It's before and after. They organize mayors, and it's just, if anything, just morale. And I just think, and it was one thing, I think what bothered me about it was how the debate became very, very silly, very, very fast in the commentary. And it actually was just a completely miserable situation for 30 million people. And he took off. The president of the United States comes to his hometown of Houston on last Friday, and he went to CPAC and was joking around about it. And I just think that hits a raw place for a lot of Texans. And so I think Republicans who didn't like Ted Cruz don't like him even more. Yeah. And it probably will be harder for him to get their vote. But I'm not convinced he's running for re-election in 2024.
You think it's an up or out? That if he does anything, it's up or out?
I think when you go to CPAC when in the middle of a crisis, when the president comes to your town, that kind of 100%. Is a clear indicator of where your interests are. But 4 years is a very long time.
100%. To just track where Ted Cruz is, the Ted Cruz journey just from 2015 to today is it's worth it. Somebody's going to have fun with that in a documentary. That's for sure. Maybe it should be you, Abby Livingston, Leanne Caldwell. Thank you both. engaging, great conversation. I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break to talk with the governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Pierluisi. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. And joining me now is the governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Pierluisi. Governor, welcome to the Toddcast here. We're talking on a day that an official statehood bill was introduced in Congress by Congressman Soto. So you are an advocate of statehood. A non-binding referendum just passed last November, indicating a narrow majority here. Walk me through what you think is the realistic path to statehood for Puerto Rico.
Well, we've had two very meaningful, very telling votes in the recent past. In 2012, 54% of the voters in Puerto Rico rejected the current territorial status of the island. That's unquestionable. That voting result speaks for itself. So basically, you have American citizens in Puerto Rico no longer consenting to the current political status of the island. Then in 2020, November of last year, for the first time in Puerto Rico's history, we held a vote up or down on statehood. I have to say that we held that referendum against all odds. The U.S. Department of Justice under the Trump administration objected to the vote, and Congress had made no offer or commitment before.
What was the objection? What was the objection to the vote?
Basically saying that we should have included all options, that just including statehood was not the right approach.
That's how it's been in the past. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, my memory serves, but that has been how statehood referendums have been defeated in the past, by offering three options, right?
We've had multiple plebiscites in which you had three or four options, or even more options. And the problem with those is that one faction or another usually claims that the definition of their option was not right, or that they were left out. You end up having boycotts. So the beauty and the wisdom of having an up or down yes or no vote is that by definition, all voters can express themselves. Those, in this case, those supporting statehood could do so, as well as those who had reservations for whatever reasons. They support other options or other status options for Puerto Rico, or they were not in agreement with the approach. Now, the vote was a majority vote. 52.5% of the voters, basically 53%, said that they want the equal rights as American citizens, because that's what we're talking about. The labels sometimes get in the way. We start talking about the statehood, the state of Puerto Rico, as opposed to the current name we give to the government of Puerto Rico, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. And for whatever reasons, it becomes controversial. But the bottom line is that all we are asking for is equal rights, equal treatment, equal privileges and responsibilities as fellow American citizens. And now the ball is in Congress's court. As simple as that. What we are doing is telling Congress to do the same. Congress, say yes or no whether you want Puerto Rico to become a state. If the members of Congress say yes, a majority of the members of Congress in both the House and the Senate, then it'll happen. Because
is there anything more you have to do from your end? You know,
yes,
the non-binding. Do you guys have to pass?
Way we're approaching this, so that nobody can claim that Congress is imposing its will on the people of Puerto Rico, because everybody should be for self-determination. So the way we're approaching this is very democratic. Congress would be saying, okay, governor of Puerto Rico, hold the vote in Puerto Rico, up or down on statehood, sanctioned by Congress, because Congress will be saying, we're ready to give right. you statehood so long as a majority of the voters, once again, reaffirm their desire to become full-fledged American right. citizens with all the rights and responsibilities.
So the biggest hurdle you're going to have is, and it was interesting to read his release last night, Marco Rubio, one of the few Republicans that is supportive of Puerto Rico statehood. He put in his statement this, Governor, I will continue to do my part to one day achieve the 60 votes needed in the Senate for admission. As part of that effort, we should help Puerto Rico recapture its former economic prosperity by passing my piece of legislation. He says, I'm urging my Senate colleagues to have an open mind, which is an acknowledgement that this is going to be a harder sell on the Republican side of the aisle to the Democratic side of the aisle. How many votes do you think you're short?
Well, my sense is that there's a lot of disinformation in Congress, particularly in the Senate. Too many Republicans apparently believe that if Puerto Rico becomes a state, that means having two Democratic senators and four Democratic representatives in the Congress.
That would be a newsflash to you, wouldn't it? Following the history of politics in Puerto Rico, it's never been monolithic, has it?
Exactly. Now you're talking. So what's happening is that they don't know Puerto Rico well enough. In Puerto Rico, I would expect people would favor candidates because of their own stance, as well as party affiliations, but not necessarily because of party affiliations. Remember that Puerto Rico has not really participated in the American democratic process. We participate in primaries. You know, some of the population participates in either Democratic or Republican primaries, but we've never voted for president. And so we're not used to doing that. And I anticipate that when the time comes, let's talk about the presidency. It'll depend on the candidates and the commitment, the candidate and the commitments he or she makes to Puerto Rico, primarily. In terms of the members of Congress, it'll be roughly the same. In Puerto Rico, our parties are organized primarily because of political status lines and not because they're Democrats or Republicans. In fact, in the pro-statehood party, I chair that party, you have lots of people who identify themselves as Republicans, for better or worse. I'm a Democrat, I'm a proud Democrat, but I realize that in Puerto Rico, you do have a sector of the population that is pretty conservative on social, you may call it moral issues. At the same time, you have a considerable sector of the population that is falls under the poverty level and is used to receiving assistance from the government for multiple purposes. It could be nutrition, health, what have you. And those, you could view them probably as more liberal. The first thing I should be telling members of Congress, particularly those in the Senate on the Republican side of the aisle, is not to prejudge the voters of Puerto Rico, to have an open mind and to look at this issue as basically what it is. Are you for democracy? Isn't America the most democratic nation in the world? How can it be that you have 3.2 million American citizens residing in Puerto Rico, and just because they reside there, they cannot vote for president, they don't have voting representation in Congress, and they do not participate in federal programs on the same basis as their fellow citizens in the states. You, Chuck, you move tomorrow to Puerto Rico, and you will be losing a lot of rights. And it makes no sense. This is like geographic discrimination. And you're not talking about a small island with just, let's say, 50,000 people. So it's hard to view.
You'd have four congressional districts. I mean, you know, that's over, you know, that's
exactly.
That's yeah. large. You know, there's at least 10 states you'd be bigger than. I think.
It's pretty sizable. Now, yeah. You said at the beginning of this conversation that the going is going to be tough in the Senate. That was the premise of your question. And I agree. I agree because of the Senate's parliamentarian rules. If they don't change this filibustering rule, you do need those 60 votes you're talking about. And so it is a hefty hurdle. The House, on the other hand, I anticipate. I served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 8 years, and I know the House. And in the past, one of my bills, a plebiscite bill for Puerto Rico, got approved by the House, and it was a strong majority, 223 votes supporting my bill. This was in 2010. Back then, actually, the Speaker of the House was Nancy Pelosi. She didn't take a stand on it, but she allowed the vote to happen. What I anticipate is going to happen this time around is that this statehood bill, which is starting very well with a lot of traction, 51, actually by now 52 co-sponsors, original co-sponsors, is going to get traction. It'll get the light of the day in the House. It'll get to the floor and it'll get approved in the House. That's my expectation. Now, that's going to put pressure on the Senate. Because, and hopefully, I know how to do this, and the resident commissioner knows as well, and there are lots of leaders in Puerto Rico that will assist us. Well, this is tough, a tough job. We will have to go one by one, having conversations with the members of the Senate, so they realize right. I am telling you that they shouldn't be prejudging Puerto Rico. By the way, another argument, Chuck, that some people make, and they just don't understand the history right. of America and territories becoming states. Some people say, oh, well, Puerto Rico, the economy of Puerto Rico is underperforming. It has been in a recession for too long. The government is facing a bankruptcy process. They're not ready. I'm sorry. No territory in the recent past was ready either along those lines. When New Mexico was trying to become a state, the debate in Congress was something. I mean, they were saying those guys don't speak the language. They're not ready. They're way behind. When Florida wanted to become a state, they were the members of Congress were saying that's a swamp. They shouldn't become a state. And when Hawaii and Alaska were trying to become states, same arguments were raised. Yesterday, Senator Martin Heinrich from New Mexico said so. I mean, he said this is like reliving history. Because this is the story of all territories, not all perhaps, but a lot of them, when they were aspiring to become states. You always aspire to do better.
I'm curious, the two Alaska Republican senators, have they been open-minded with you on this?
Yeah, Lisa Murkowski is. I mean, I know for a fact. I mean, she supports statehood for Puerto Rico. She's a conservative, a moderate to conservative member of the Senate.
But I got to think she's empathetic to the other arguments you're making.
Yeah. And Don Young is like the lion of Alaska, the dean of the House. He's been a proponent of this issue forever. And Hawaii, by the way, most of the Florida congressional delegation is supporting Puerto Rico on this one. The same applies with Hawaii. The same applies with in a lot of places.
Do you have Rick Scott too?
I'm sorry?
You have Rick Scott and I know you have Rubio. Do you have Rick Scott as well?
In the past, he's expressed support for statehood.
Right. It's interesting that you say in the past. Are you a little nervous that he could get wobbly?
Well, I shouldn't say I'm nervous. I know he's close to our resident commissioner, Jennifer Gonzalez. She is our...
He made a huge effort, right? I mean, he certainly walked the walk for a while on some of these issues.
Yeah. And she's our top Republican. But I have to say that Senator Scott has called me on several occasions ever since I assumed office. ever since I won the election, to offer help, to volunteer, to assist us, to count on him. So I see him as an ally. I see Marco Rubio as an ally as well, because their Florida delegation supports us. I mean, in Florida, you have 1.1 million citizens of Puerto Rican origin. So that's strong. In fact, that's the state that has the most Puerto Ricans.
Past New York?
Within its borders. Yeah. I believe so. I believe they're very close, but I think that.
How does DC's, how does Washington, D.C.'s push for statehood help or hinder what you're trying to do?
You know, it's a similar quest what D.C. Has, and I support very much making D.C. a state. In the House, the D.C. has gotten overwhelming support from Democratic quarters, not so from the Republican side of the aisle. The Senate remains to be seen. But these two quests can run on a parallel basis, simultaneously. And what I anticipate happening is that in the House, you'll get a vote on D.C. statehood like you've gotten in the past. And I anticipate we will be getting a vote on Puerto Rico statehood as well in this term, in this congressional term. In the Senate, it remains to be seen. I'll be doing the tough work along with others, with the resident commissioner, one-on-one with members of the Senate. Just to give you an example, today, for example, I was talking to Senator Cardin. And Senator Cardin is very much on our side. I mean, he says he wants to support us. I've had in the past conversations with Senator Kaine, Tim Kaine. He's very much supportive. Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut came out strong recently. He hadn't come out strong for statehood, and he did just recently because they see the writing on the wall. They know that this is coming, and it might not happen then within the next 2 years, but let's see what happens in the next congressional midterm elections. If the Senate may change in its composition, the filibustering rule may not be around, so this 60-vote hurdle might not be applicable. So we'll go step by step, but we'll work it because I have a mandate. By the way, I have to say this. Statehood got more votes than I did and anybody else.
There you go. You feel like that's your mandate. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a mandate. And I respect those who do not support statehood. Let me say this, Chuck. It's important. I respect them. But
Are the opponents more for independence or more for keeping the status quo?
No, I would say that, independence has always gotten a very small percentage in any multiple option plebiscite in the past. There are those now in Puerto Rico who believe Puerto Rico should become a sovereign nation and then keep some kind of association with the state, similar to what Palau and Marshall Islands have. Those are islands in the middle of the Pacific that have like a pact with the U.S. Providing assistance from the U.S.
But they're not American citizens, are they?
Yeah, they don't need a lot of them are. Some are not.
Some are not.
And they can come in and out of the U.S. without visa requirements and so on. So the immigration rules do not apply to them the same they do elsewhere. Now, so some in Puerto Rico are looking for a deal like that. But again, that's not a majority. It doesn't even get close. I would say that, and then you have those who are simply not ready yet. They do not have all the information they need to take the step. Now, one thing that I keep saying, and I know that in the U.S., there's a sector of the population that probably that definitely doesn't agree with me. But I believe the U.S. is a very diverse country. And I believe that there's room in the U.S. for having a truly Hispanic state. I believe having a state like Puerto Rico, you know, with both English and Spanish as official languages, with people who are very proud of their heritage, their culture, their customs, their way of living, is an asset to the nation. We will diversify the nation further. We will always be an island in the Caribbean, the same way Hawaii is an archipelago or in the Pacific, and it has contributed quite so much to the U.S. So that's what's happening in Puerto Rico. People should have an open mind and realize what's the problem with having a beautiful island. Actually, it's like three or four islands. We're also an archipelago, but having beautiful islands in the Caribbean as a permanent part of America, you know, this is something. This is thinking big. This is being bold. This is what this is being positive about America, expanding America.
I'm curious, do you think you have any route in the courts in this respect? The fact that Puerto Ricans are not protected by the citizenship clause in the 14th Amendment, the fact that Congress could revoke citizenship, right, to any Puerto Rican, that feels very un-American. Do you think you have a route in the courts on that front?
It does. I have, you know, there have been cases in the courts and dealing with this issue of you know, second class citizenship, and also dealing with the fact that Puerto Rico, for all intents and purposes, has become an incorporated territory. Actually, the reason why Puerto Rico gets disparate treatment or different treatment in key federal programs arises from cases of the Supreme Court that were decided very early in the 20th century. Another time in America's history, the opinions, if you read them, Chuck, they're full of prejudice.
You can tell it's sort of an out of touch
court. Yes, and it's incredible that the Supreme Court hasn't overruled that precedent because it is not right.
Now, look, I think it's one of your best reasons to ask for statehood. This mistreatment of American citizens.
Exactly. Now I have to say one thing. The way the U.S. Constitution works, you have states, you have the Indian tribes, you have territories. That's all the U.S. Constitution talks about. And when it talks about voting for president, it basically gives that vote to the residents of the states, basically. And if you want to include, for example, like it happened with the District of Columbia, residents of, in this case, the District of Columbia, as part of the Electoral College, you need to amend the U.S. Constitution. And that's a different battle altogether. You don't, to amend the U.S. Constitution, you need 2/3 majority in both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And you need a 3/4 majority at the state legislative assemblies. So it is a huge hurdle. If my recollection serves me right, when the District of Columbia got the presidential vote for its residents, it was a razor thin margin. It was simply by one state that they made it. It was very close, very close, is my recollection. So it is a tough battle. So getting the presidential vote for the residents of Puerto Rico is something that I would rather do through a statehood bill. It's easier to get a state amendment to the House and the Senate than an amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Right. And so that's the approach I have made so far. Right now, by the way, the First Circuit, the Court of Appeals, U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, ruled recently that the American citizens residing in Puerto Rico should be eligible to for the SSI program, the Supplemental Security Income Program. Mm-hmm. These are people with disabilities primarily. Now, the Supreme Court has taken cert, you know, accepted cert, and it'll be reviewing that case. Mm-hmm. So every now and then you get cases in which the courts are saying, you know, this makes no sense. I mean, SSI, that should be available to all U.S. citizens, regardless of whether they're paying taxes or not. In fact, a lot of them, I'm pretty sure, do not pay federal income taxes because of their income levels, yet they get those benefits. And if you don't give those benefits to people in Puerto Rico, what you're simply doing is motivating them to hop on a plane and move to Florida or New York or the Carolinas. So as a matter of federal policy, it makes no sense.
Before I let you go, do you feel the debt issue, which got a lot of attention, do you feel like that's something you have to figure out and solve before as a way to make it easier for senators to support statehood?
Well, actually, we're making a lot of progress along those lines. The oversight board we have in Puerto Rico is about to submit a plan of adjustment to the federal court that is overseeing this bankruptcy process. And my expectation is that that plan of adjustment will get approved by the court. And so we will be able to restructure the debt of the Commonwealth, pretty much all of the debt of the Commonwealth in the near term, in the near future. You know, it might take a year, but within a year, we should have this debt restructuring behind us. And so we will still have that oversight board because the way the law was drafted, the law that created the oversight board, it requires that Puerto Rico balance its budgets, the Commonwealth balances its budgets for four consecutive years. We haven't been able to balance the budgets up to now because we haven't had the debt restructuring and the debt service hasn't been paid. But from the moment that debt restructuring is approved by the court, we will be able to balance the budgets as required by that law called PROMESA, and then the board will have an expiration date on it. My expectation is that if Puerto Rico becomes a state, which as I hope, before that four-year term, then the board would cease to exist because no state can have an oversight board.
Right.
That only happens with territories and municipalities in the states.
Yep, we had a famous control board in Washington, D.C. A couple of decades ago. Governor, this has been terrific. I appreciate the time you gave me here. And I have a feeling that we're closer to statehood than ever. We'll just see how close we really are. Governor, appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chuck.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Green, Matt Rivera, and Megan Leibowitz. John Reese is our executive producer. Our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. And the big show is every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening, and until we upload it.